This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 20th, 2008. Sitting in for Auro Bogado in Los Angeles, I'm Tandisizwe Shimaringa. Pakistan's future may include a changing of its old guard. Separatists in Nepal organize a regional shutdown of the country. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton look toward the South and the Midwest to give them what they need. And the U.S. plans to shoot down its own spy satellite. Those stories and more today, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr may allow the Mehdi army's ceasefire to expire this week in reaction to arrests and assaults targeting al-Sadr supporters. The cleric's move to freeze his militia's activities began last August after months of bloodshed as sectarian militias fought with each other and against Iraqi and U.S. forces. An al-Sadr spokesman said today that the ceasefire will effectively be over on Sunday unless al-Sadr announces an extension by Saturday. The possible resumption of Mehdi army activities could obliterate many of the security achievements that have allowed Iraqi leaders to reach some progress towards national reconciliation between Sunni and Shiite factions. Tension in Serbian enclaves within Kosovo continues to run high 3 days after Kosovo's declaration of independence from Serbia. Amy Miller reports from Belgrade.
United Nations and KFOR police forces returned this afternoon to border crossing posts in northern Kosovo after they were forced to withdraw yesterday when an angry crowd blew up their checkpoints in the Serbian enclave of Mitrovica. The crossings reopened after leaders of the Serbian enclaves had announced that they will organize more protests if KFOR does not allow traffic through the checkpoints. Today, barbed wire was spread on the bridge of the Ibar River, separating the northern Serb and southern Albanian parts of Mitrovica, the largest town in the area. This has led to speculation that a partitioning of the province by completely cutting off movement between the two parts of the town may soon follow. A total of 4 university faculties in Kosovo's northern, predominantly Serb-inhabited areas were evacuated today due to anonymous threats. A similar alert forced the evacuation of a Serbian elementary school yesterday. Despite the rising tensions, Kosovo lawmakers have continued to press ahead with their nation-building project, passing legislation on to create Kosovo citizenship, passports, and a foreign ministry. Reporting for FSRN from Belgrade, this is Amy Miller.
Hundreds of farmers and workers blocked railway routes in the northern Indian city of Ludhiana today to protest against privatization of public services and utilities. Bismili Gilani reports.
Thousands of passengers were stranded as the rail traffic on the Ludhiana-Delhi route came to a halt due to the 4-hour statewide blockade. The blockade was called by a coalition of 18 farmers and workers organizations to protest against plans by the government of Punjab to privatize electricity, education and health services. The agitators carrying banners and placards sat on the railway tracks near Ludhiana station blocking movement of all Delhi-bound trains for 4 hours. The protesters say the privatization of basic services would hit the state's poor the hardest. The Punjab government's privatization plan has evoked severe criticism from the poorer sections of the populace, and the state has witnessed massive protest rallies and sit-ins in the past months. But the state government shows no signs of change of mind on the issue. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
The Supreme Court is hearing its second case of the week on workplace retaliation. Plaintiffs in both cases argue that employers retaliated against them after complaints of discrimination. In yesterday's case, a former U.S. Post Office employee complained of age discrimination. In today's case, a Cracker Barrel contractor alleged racial discrimination. The court is due to hear a third workplace retaliation case later this year. Decisions on this week's cases are expected in late spring or early summer. Confrontations between coca growers and Colombian police left at least 20 injured in rural Colombia today. Over 2,000 small farmers are protesting the government's latest coca eradication plan. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
Yesterday's violent incidents occurred in Antioquia province after peasants destroyed a toll booth along the highway that connects Medellin, Colombia's second largest city, to the Caribbean coast. Thousands of coca growers have camped out in Tarasa and other nearby towns since Friday to protest President Álvaro Uribe's latest coca eradication initiative. The government sent hundreds of troops and civilians to this rural area of Colombia last week to uproot thousands of acres of coca crops. The manufacture and trafficking of cocaine has played a central role in funding both guerrillas and paramilitaries in the country's decades-long armed conflict. Most of the peasants involved in these protests sell coca to guerrilla groups, and the government wants them to substitute their coca plantations with legal crops like organic coffee. But peasant leaders say that the protests will continue until the government provides a secure income base. They claim that government subsidies for growing crops like coffee do not go far enough, and they fear guerrilla groups will attack them if they stop coca production. Manuel Reyda, FSRN, Bogota.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The United States government is planning to shut down its own malfunctioning spy satellite in the next couple of days by firing a missile from a Navy ship located somewhere in the North Pacific. The stated goal of the mission is to destroy 1,000 pounds of a poisonous gas on board the satellite that officials say could injure and kill people on the ground when the object falls to Earth. But critics of the plan are questioning the official story and worry if this event is an escalation of the militarization of space. Eric Klein has more.
At last week's Pentagon press briefing, announcing the plans to the public, Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor James Jeffries explained that falling satellites were nothing new in the last three decades, but that there were special circumstances this time.
It was a possibility of death or injury to human beings beyond that associated with the fall of satellites and other space objects normally, if we can use that word. Specifically, there was enough of a risk for the president to be quite concerned about human life. And on that basis, he asked us to review our options.
Jeffries explained that the satellite is carrying hydrazine, a fuel propellant that could cause a deadly cloud of poison gas when it crashes to the Earth. So the option President Bush decided upon was to shoot the satellite down with a missile, destroying the fuel tank and increasing the likelihood that the rest of the satellite will fall into the ocean. The super-secret spy satellite belongs to the National Reconnaissance Office. It was launched in December 2006, but never worked, and has been degrading in its orbit ever since. It will fall to Earth on its own in a matter of weeks. Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General James Cartwright, described the possible dangers to the public from the hydrazine gas if it made landfall in a populated area. The area affected would be roughly 100 square yards.
You're at risk to an extent that you'll recognize that you're in trouble, you'll start to walk to where you feel like you're better off, and you'll still need to see a doctor. And that's as close. And if you stay and you're not ambulatory for whatever reason and you stay in a concentrated area, you could eventually get yourself to a point where death would fall.
General Cartwright also spoke briefly on the historical significance of this event.
This is the first time we've used a tactical missile to engage a spacecraft, but not the first time that we've used a tactical missile to engage a body that is just re-entering.
General Cartwright said that the missile being used was designed to intercept short- and medium-range ballistic missiles as they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. He said the software on the missile was modified to shoot down the falling spy satellite.
What this really is about is this idea of hit-to-kill technology.
Jeffrey Lewis is the director of the Nuclear Strategy Initiative at the New America Foundation and publisher of the blog armscontrolwonk.com. The risk he's concerned about is not the unlikely possibility of a small cloud of poison gas released in a city, but the large boost the technology known as missile defense will receive around the world. Lewis says that the U.S. should be working to stigmatize rather than normalize this practice.
The United States is very dramatically making the point that hit-to-kill technologies can be used to intercept missiles and can be used to shoot down satellites. And so I think it becomes very hard if you're an Indian or a Chinese or a Russian military official not to say we want that technology too.
Chinese and Russian officials have expressed concern over the plan. Lewis says that the U.S. could easily dispel the suspicions of other nations and administration critics by releasing the data the Defense Department and NASA used to calculate the risk of the falling satellite landing in a populated area. In early 2007, China destroyed one of its own satellites with a missile, causing a dangerous amount of debris that will remain in orbit for decades. U.S. officials say that if their anti-satellite mission is a success, then all of the debris will fall to Earth within a few short weeks. Jeffrey Lewis explains why missile defense is considered dangerous by arms control experts.
The historical concern about missile defenses and anti-satellites play into this is if you have a defense, you wouldn't just wait for the other guy to hit you. What you would do is hit them first, and then you would use the missile defense to sort of mop up whatever survived. anti-satellite weapons have the same sort of feature to them, which is they're much better if you use them first. And that creates a kind of hair trigger situation where a lot of countries worry that the space assets they depend on are really, really vulnerable. And in a crisis, particularly, say, between the United States and China over Taiwan, the impulse to go first grows the more vulnerable your space assets are.
The latest news available at airtime is that the missile launch planned for Wednesday evening may be delayed due to rough weather in the North Pacific. Pentagon officials say that the mission to shoot down the falling spy satellite could be rescheduled for a later date, up to the 29th of February, when the spacecraft will fall to Earth on its own. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
Democratic candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton now move on to the next phase of the 2008 presidential campaign after Obama received a huge win in Wisconsin. He beat Clinton in every demographic, including her strongholds of working-class white voters. Meanwhile, both candidates are highlighting their plan for trade on the campaign trail. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Laying it all on the line, Hillary Clinton gave a speech in New York Wednesday morning that will set the tone of her campaign for the next 2 weeks until the next primaries on March 4th. She's contrasting herself to rival Barack Obama.
That is all we're asking for. We're asking to compare our records. We're asking to compare our years of service. We're asking to compare our ideas, our solutions.
Clinton's loss in Wisconsin was downplayed, as the campaign maintains they are focusing on Ohio and Texas. In Wisconsin, the only group Clinton was able to hold on to was white voters over 65. Obama won among low-income voters, less educated voters, voting blocks Clinton has appealed to previously. Obama also appealed to people on all issues, those who thought the most important issue was Iraq, people who are worried about the economy, and those who think health care is most important. Obama gave his Wisconsin victory speech in Texas, home to the next big contest.
Everybody knows that you can start voting today. And if you didn't vote today, you can start tomorrow or the next day or the day after that. But we have early voting in Texas. I don't want you to wait until March 4th.
Both Clinton and Obama are attempting to appeal to workers, especially in Ohio, which also votes on March 4th. Highlighting trade policies, Obama is linking Hillary to her husband Bill Clinton's implementation of NAFTA. As for Obama's ideas on NAFTA, he offers few solutions, but he says he would work with Mexico and Canada to amend the agreement. In an effort to respond to Obama's successful attacks on her husband's NAFTA implementation, Clinton herself unveiled a detailed plan on how to fix NAFTA. Now, a more aggressive opponent of the trade agreement, Clinton says she would update environmental and labor protections for American workers and enhance enforcement mechanisms. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is reporting that the 1.4 million member Teamsters Union is expected to endorse Obama. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
For the first time in the history of Hawaii, voters are having a say in the national presidential election, where 29 delegates from the third smallest state may have a role in determining the Democratic Party's nominee in August. Ann Kiala Kelly reports from one of the precincts that handed Senator Barack Obama a landslide caucus victory.
Thousands of people lined up outside elementary schools across the state, with the vast majority caucusing for the first time.
This is a great evening for democracy.
Congressman Neil Abercrombie, a supporter of Senator Barack Obama, speaks to the hundreds of people crammed into the Manoa Elementary School cafeteria in Honolulu moments before the first caucus votes are to be cast. Outside are 2,000 people waiting for a chance to take part. And this is just one of 81 locations across the state.
There are lines hundreds of yards long at all the different schools, all the different places, all over the state. This is such a thrill. It fills me with such deep emotion that this is the most grassroots democracy of all, our precinct meetings and our caucus meetings, and congratulations to one and all.
But for as excited as people in Hawaii are about actually having a say in who the Democratic Party candidate will be, their motivation appears to be the refrain from the Barack Obama campaign, the need for change. Pi'ikea Miller, a first-time caucus participant, stood in one of the long lines with her one-month-old son.
when you look at the options, John McCain, I think, is just going to be a continuation of more of the horrible policies and, you know, presidency that we've had with George Bush. And I think with Hillary Clinton, I really feel that she represents sort of the machine, the big political machine, and I don't think that she's going to be much of a voice for change in America.
Although Manoa and almost every other valley on Oahu and throughout the archipelago have come out for Obama, Clinton supporters are also out.
I think it's really important to come out and, you know, place my vote.
Jane Hamill is a nurse, and she says she's inspired by Obama, but doesn't have faith in his campaign because of what she calls his lack of experience.
I think that he would really honestly get eaten alive in Washington. Jimmy Carter is a wonderful man, but he was not a successful president. And I think that we're facing the same thing. It's not on-the-job training. You know, you have to really go in there and know the system. And whether he says, you know, we don't want the same old thing, you have to have more experience than he has. I think it's so important that we elect Hillary.
What Hamill and other Clinton supporters talk about are Clinton's years of experience and a sense of continuity and purpose. Hana Miyamoto, one of the precinct volunteers and a Clinton supporter, agrees with Hamill.
One of the first things she was doing as a young woman was trying to get black professors at her college, Wellesley, which at the time had zero. When you talk about who's done more for African Americans, you might seriously wonder about whether it's Hillary.
But by the time the voting started, it had become clear that if Manoa Valley is any indication, the majority of Hawaii voters are out to support their hometown favorite, Honolulu-born and raised Senator Barack Obama.
You can vote for whoever you want to vote for, hand it back to the person that gave it to you, and you are free to leave. The voting begins now.
For Free Speech Radio News in Honolulu, I'm Anne Keala Kelly.
President Bush today called Monday's parliamentary elections in Pakistan a victory for the people and a victory on the war on terror. He said he hoped the new government will be friends of the United States. So far, unofficial results published by Pakistani media show a majority of the 268 National Assembly seats going to Pakistan's opposition parties, with the Pakistan People's Party in control of 88 seats, the party of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif holding 65 seats, and the ruling party of President Pervez Musharraf securing just 42 seats. The government says it will release official election results on March 1st. From Islamabad, Zach Badoff reports.
About 45% of Pakistan's registered voters cast their ballots Monday, up 2% from the last elections in 2002. The results mean the Pakistan People's Party and Nawaz Sharif's party could form the two-thirds coalition necessary to impeach President Pervez Musharraf and change the nation's constitution. Senator Mujahid Hussain Saeed, the Secretary General of the ruling PMLQ party, said he's not satisfied with his party's performance at the polls, saying it was below expectations.
But we are Democrats, and we accept the verdict of the people because that is something that is paramount for us, the supremacy of the ballot box.
Syed said his party set a new tradition for the country.
In Pakistan, most of the parties are sore losers. We have accepted our defeat with good grace and an open heart. And we would like to work to strengthen the democratic system by serving as a robust and vibrant opposition.
But one of Saeed's colleagues in the Senate, Latif Khosa, said his party, the Pakistan People's Party, was robbed and cheated of victory of nearly 40 seats. In charge of the election monitoring cell for his party, Khosa said the results were overturned through manipulations of official machinery.
Notwithstanding the fact that there have been massive rigging to keep us out, starting from the elimination of our great leader, Muhtarma Benazir Bhutto, Still, they could not stop us from getting the largest number of votes and the largest number of seats in Pakistan.
They've done very well. They've come out number one.
Again, PMLQ leader Mujahid Hussain Saeed.
What more do they expect? Not one observer, not one media person at home and abroad has talked of rigging. And if the elections had been rigged, they wouldn't have won.
And for the most part, he's right. In the capital today, the Democracy International Monitoring Mission found the vote to be executed smoothly and conducted largely according to established procedures. But the delegation's head, former Congressman Jim Moody, said it did not fully meet international standards.
Despite a seriously flawed and difficult pre-election period and an environment, the February 18th elections provided a genuine opportunity for Pakistani voters to express their will.
Moody congratulated the millions of Pakistani voters who took a leap of faith by going to the polls. He said the role of his USAID-funded mission deterred fraud and manipulation, while also double-checking the election results. The PPP's COSA said the vote was a massive mandate for change and a rejection of retired General Musharraf. For his part, the president said he's not considering resigning or retiring. Not yet, he said. He says he'll serve out his 5-year term, which ends in 2012. Musharraf met U.S. Senators Joe Biden, John Kerry, and Chuck Hagel yesterday in Islamabad during the American legislators' visit to Pakistan for the elections. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Biden said he was reassured by Musharraf that the retired Army chief will abide by and cooperate with the new coalition government.
This is an opportunity for us to move from a policy that's been focused on a personality to one based upon an entire people.
Biden and the other U.S. senators stressed the importance of cooperation between political parties in the new government.
First and foremost, the most single important thing, presumptuous of an outsider to say, is for Pakistan parties to get their house in order.
After the senator's press conference, a Pakistani reporter for the local Dawn newspaper argued with Kerry about America's role in the country.
Your constitutional process is working, and you will have a new government with a new prime minister, a new parliament.
As long as you're supporting Musharraf, the Americans are supporting Musharraf, there will be no change.
We are not supporting any one individual. We're supporting the new parliament, and we're supporting the elections. And that should be as clear as bell.
As a democracy dividend, Biden said the U.S. should triple non-military aid to Pakistan, while focusing more on military assistance accountability. In Islamabad, I'm Zach Badorf with Mudassir Shah for Free Speech Radio News.
For the past 8 days, southern Nepal has been in the grip of an indefinite shutdown. Organized by communities of Indian origin that are popularly called Madheshis, the purpose is to pressure the Nepalese government to concede to the Madheshis' 6-point charter demands. The group's major demand is the carving out of an autonomous Madhesh state within Nepal, with the ultimate right to self-determination. The Nepalese government has refused to concede this demand, contending that it could affect the very integrity and sovereignty of the country. The government has agreed to grant adequate representation to the Madheshi in the army, parliament, and all spheres of power, but this is not enough to satiate the Madheshis, and they've resorted to the indefinite shutdown, causing massive upheaval in the mountainous country and threatening the very prospect of the upcoming April 10th Constituent Assembly poll. PC Dubey in Kathmandu files this report.
The general strike, which began February 13, has paralyzed Nepal. No foodstuffs, no gasoline, no cooking fuel are reaching the hilly region of northern Nepal, bordering China's Tibet, including capital Kathmandu, because the ethnic Indian origin Madheshis have slapped total shutdown in southern region bordering India. This has disrupted regular movement. Madheshis are seeking an autonomous state with right to self-determination. A dearth of gasoline has kept nearly 1 million Kathmandu children from getting to school. The children depend upon public and private transport to reach their schools. These goods mainly come from India and have to pass through southern Nepal. Dr. Mahesh Pakhurel, director of Kathmandu-based medical college, has said that the shutdown has curbed functioning of the hospital, impacting patient care.
We are facing hassles in transporting our staff to the hospital. Even we have a fuel crunch for our ambulances. You have to strive hard and stand in queues for a long time to buy petrol. It's even difficult to carry doctors for night and emergency duties. This is causing whopping harassment.
But the problems caused by the strike are not dissuading the Madhesi leadership from maintaining the shutdown. At the same time, violence has erupted in several districts. Clashes between the strike supporters and the security force have resulted in 2 deaths and more than 500 injured over the past 8 days. And an indefinite curfew has been imposed in several towns of southern Nepal. Madhav Prasad Regmi, a senior government official in southern Nepal, says Madhesi's agitators were fomenting sectarian violence which government was determined to contain.
We are imposing curfew to cope with the vicious scenario of violence and mayhem. Agitators are attacking the security forces. They are highly provocative. They are also hell-bent to disturb the social and sectarian harmony. So we have to take up tough measures such as these.
The government says it is seeking a dialogue with Madhesi leaders to end the shutdown and restore normalcy so that the process for the prospective April 10 Constituent Assembly election could move unhindered. But the Madhesi leaders are not willing to end the shutdown unless their major demands are accepted. However, they have indicated they could negotiate if the government evinced genuine interest to address their grievances. Top Madhesi leader Upendra Yadav says their protest was intended to remain peaceful and adds that it is the state that is resorting to terror and violence against the Madhesi people.
We may join the process of dialogue only after the government stops repression. Parleys and repression can't go on simultaneously. If this situation continues like this, we won't participate in the election.
Madhesi leader Yadav has, however, stressed that the government would have to first even accept their 6-point demands, mainly the creation of an autonomous Madhesi state with the right to self-determination. Otherwise, the dialogue would lead nowhere.
With these clear demands in mind, the government would have to address the Madhesi agitation. Then only some substantial results would follow.
But the 7-party ruling alliance leaders, including Prime Minister G.P. Koirala, have already ruled out the possibility of an autonomous Madhesi state with the right for self-determination. And with that, for the moment, it appears that the stalemate will continue. From Birganj in Nepal, I am P.C. Dubey for FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org.